Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. Most of us know Samuel F. B. Morse for his invention of the telegraph. As our guest this week, Kenneth Silverman, makes clear, Morse was indeed a man of genius and talent. But as Silverman also points out in his new book, Lightning Man, Morse's life was also accursed. Following John Herron's conversation with Kenneth Silverman, William Lambers will join us to talk about nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and Alex Berza returns with another of his wonderful historical hoaxes. But first, let's look at an item of historical interest in the news on Oskar Schindler. A new biography of Oskar Schindler clashes sharply with his portrayal in the Oscar-winning 1993 movie Schindler's List and the 1982 historical novel by Thomas Keneally. Schindler was the German businessman who saved more than 1,000 Jews from the Nazis. The Schindler who emerges in this latest account, based on interviews with Holocaust survivors and newly discovered papers, including letters stored in a suitcase by a mistress, is far more flawed than the one depicted in the movie and novel. To begin with, there was no one Schindler's List, and Schindler had almost nothing to do with the list, reports David M. Crow, a professor at Elon University in North Carolina, in his new book, Oskar Schindler, The Untold Account of His Life, Wartime Activities, and the True Story Behind the List. Crow said there were 9 lists. The first 4 were drawn up primarily by Marshall Goldberg, a corrupt Jewish security police officer and assistant to an SS officer in charge of transporting Jews. Schindler suggested a few names, but did not know most of the people on the lists. The authors of the 5 other lists are unknown. Crow writes that the legend of the list arose partly from Schindler's efforts to embellish his heroism. Those he saved further enhanced the legend because they adored him and protected him. After the war, Schindler was a failure. He squandered money given to him by the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee and moved to Argentina, where he attempted to breed nutria. He then returned to Germany and bought a concrete factory, where workers attacked him for saving Jews during the war. The factory went bankrupt. For the rest of his life, Schindler lived off the money he was able to beg from the Jews he had saved. He died in 1974 of alcoholism and excessive smoking. When we return, John Herron talks with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Kenneth Silverman. William Lambers comments on the threat of nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and Alex Berza tells us about another of his hoaxes from history, this one from the BBC Radio. This is Talking History. Samuel F. B. Morse was a man of genius and one of the best-known people of his time, but he was also a troubled man in many ways. That's the subject of John Herron's conversation this week with Morse biographer Kenneth Silverman.
Throughout most of the 19th century, Samuel Morse, inventor and promoter of the American telegraph, was heralded as a second Benjamin Franklin, the most illustrious man of his time. His contemporaries believed him to be a many-sided genius, and wealth, fame, even international acclaim rained down on Morse in the 1850s and 1860s. Yet as our guest for this week illustrates, Morse's life was defined not by these accolades, but rather by his moral uncertainty, political naivete, and nagging restlessness. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Kenneth Silverman is Professor Emeritus of English at New York University. He is an accomplished biographer and has written widely on American life and culture. His most recent work, Lightning Man, The Accursed Life of Samuel F. B. Morse, was published in 2003 by Alfred A. Knopf. Welcome, Ken.
Good to be here.
You have written biographies of Cotton Mather, Edgar Allan Poe, and Harry Houdini. What drew you to Samuel Morse?
Well, I've been doing a series of, sort of my portrait gallery of iconic figures, representative figures in American culture. I've done a minister, an entertainer, a poet. I wanted to get a technologist in there somewhere, and Morse fit the bill. That's one of many reasons.
Well, Morse is best known, obviously, for the telegraph, but much of his life was spent in pursuits far removed from technology, right?
Oh, yes. Morse was He had many interests, mostly as a painter. I mean, he was spent the first half of his life as a very well-known portrait and historical painter and as a professor of fine arts at New York University.
Are you a fan of Morse's paintings?
Oh, yes, very much. His best portraits have a kind of tough-minded realism, sort of refusal to flatter the sitters, and then his really ambitious canvases are really are remarkable in their, well, in many respects, and mostly, I suppose, in their size. His picture of the House of Representatives has portraits of, whatever, 70 or 80 members of the House and justices of the Supreme Court. Very ambitious work.
So he spent part of his life as a portrait artist, but he was never comfortable being a portrait artist. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely right. Our theory at the time, and beginning in the late 18th century, held that portrait painting was the lowest branch of painting. I mean, you were bound to your patron. The patron could tell you, do this, do that. I want to appear in a black suit. I want to be shown with this furniture. You were sort of a hired flatterer. And Morse never enjoyed really doing portrait painting.
Still, he did get considerable acclaim for his artistic efforts.
Yes, but not for the paintings he most wanted to do, which were these large historical canvases. Especially, he wanted to do one of the huge frescoes in the dome of the U.S. Capitol. He was going to do perhaps the landing of Columbus or maybe the landing of the Mayflower. Congress didn't hire him to do the work. It was a tremendous disappointment to him.
Beyond those paintings, what other things did Morse do with his life?
Well, his family always worried that he was fickle, that he moved from one thing to another. At one time, he thought of becoming a minister like his father. At another time, he got very seriously into photography. When he was in Paris, he met Daguerre, the inventor of the daguerreotyping process, and he brought Daguerre's process back to New York and opened even a photography studio here and ran the studio for a year or so. Became deeply involved in politics, ran twice for mayor of New York and once as a representative of his district near Poughkeepsie. He moved around a lot, you know, intellectually, socially. He had many interests.
His political career was certainly less noteworthy than his artistic career. What led Morse into politics?
Well, Morse was a passionate cultural nationalist. And, you know, the 19th century was a time of very romantic and very involved kind of nationalism. Americans were very anxious to prove to Europeans that they could have inventors, they could have painters, they could have writers, they could have musicians, quite as much as the old world could. And Morse was one of these cultural nationalists, and it inevitably brought him into politics. His father had been in politics, too, inevitably as a Congregationalist minister near Boston.
Beyond that cultural nationalist, what other kinds of political values did Morse support?
Well, he was, I guess one would say, very conservative. I mean, he was deeply opposed to immigration, especially to immigration of Catholics. He thought that, as a lot of other Americans did, he believed that the church was really trying to take over the American government and that Rome and Austria were united in some kind of plot to undo and destabilize the country. So he was very anti-immigration. He was also very anti-abolition. We'd have to get deeply into his theology and to really understand his views, but basically he was a serious pro-slavery advocate, especially as the Civil War drew closer and closer.
Those political, I guess we could call them missteps aside, given his artistic achievements and especially the eventual success of the Telegraph, why the subtitle of your work, The Accursed Life of Samuel Morse?
Well, Morse had many successes. His Telegraph brought him ultimately $1 million or so. He got quite a large reputation as a painter and so on. And yet he felt that with every success, with every triumph, came some tremendous failure. He felt as if his life was somehow cast as a series of boomerangs. I mean, anything he threw out there that was for his own good, for his own success, eventually came back and hurt him. I suppose an early example of that was when he was given a commission to paint a full-length portrait of the Marquis de Lafayette. It was a very highly sought commission, and some of the best-known American painters tried to get the commission, but it went to Morse. He went to Washington, D.C., where Lafayette was, and he was painting Lafayette there, and got a letter from home saying that his young wife had died. She had just gone into bed and died, presumably, of some heart ailment. But that, for Morse, was sort of the pattern of his life, that any time some prosperity came to him, it was met by some awful kind of defeat.
So he would feel that in his personal life as well as in his professional life?
Very much so. In everything that he did, yes.
Well, that transition from an artist and politician to an inventor seems like an abrupt one. What drew Morse to the telegraph?
Well, as I say, he always had many interests, and he had been interested, really, in science and technology early on when he was an undergraduate at Yale University. He had taken courses in science there. I mean, Yale had certainly the best science department of any university in the country. He had done some electrical experiments with his teachers. Later, he had done some inventing, too, with his brother, one of his two brothers. They had invented a flexible valve that could be used in various pumps, including fire pumps, and that could therefore bring fire engines, workable fire engines, within the, make them affordable to villages all over the United States. He had a sort of history of interest in invention and in science by the time that he came to thinking about the telegraph.
There was, I understand, considerable controversy over origins and ownership of the telegraph. How much can we give Morse credit for the discovery itself of the telegraph?
Well, that, of course, gets to be an enormously complicated story and takes up many of the pages of my book. I mean, it's like the other great inventions of the 19th century. I mean, the Cyrix, McCormick's Reaper, and so on, they were constantly under attack by people who said that they really had invented, or they weren't given credit for having a large part in the invention, and so on. What can be said is that I think Morse clearly invented the American electromagnetic telegraph. I mean, there were European telegraphs, but they didn't work in the same way. They weren't as simple as Morse's. They weren't as powerful as Morse's. There were other American telegraphs, too, but they didn't work by electromagnetism. The telegraph that really became the sort of standard, that was the simplest to use, the simplest to operate, most inexpensive to operate, that really was Morse's invention. And more than that, he promoted it against tremendous odds, and nobody out there was very willing to help him, but he kept at it. He kept at it with Congress, trying to get an appropriation to build an experimental line. He pushed it constantly, day in and day out. I mean, I think he deserves much credit for it.
You write that the telegraph was as much a revolution to 1840 America as the Internet was to 1990 America. How did Morse and his contemporaries believe that the telegraph would transform American life?
Oh, in practically every way, and in many ways it did. There was a strong streak of utopianism at the time, and as happened with the Internet, too. You know, a lot of people were talking about globalization and turning the world into a global village. People would communicate with each other across enormous distances, and that was bound to bring peace, bring a new reign of quiet and mutual respect on Earth. None of that happened, needless to say. But the hope was there. In fact, however, the telegraph brought about enormous changes in commerce and in banking, and great changes in journalism. Stories could be reported almost as soon as they were happening. When the Mexican War arose, you could get a story from the front there in Mexico to Washington, to the people of the time at least, with unbelievable speed, and it led to the formation of the Associated Press and setting up of bureaus all over the United States and ultimately all over the world. Transformed social life in many ways. You know, Dad was sick in Boston. Dad could telegraph and say, you know, I'm feeling better. Enormous changes on really almost every part of American life.
So what should have been a very crowning achievement, especially for Morse, was marred by what we've talked about, the controversies over ownership and his legal troubles. Morse found himself engaged in a near endless series of lawsuits. Why the litigation?
Yes, he was sued over and over and over and over and over again. Finally, the litigation all came to the United States Supreme Court, which gave Morse there, in fact, quite a huge victory. Copyright law was not so clear then. Patent law, as it still isn't. I mean, patents today are still subject to a lot of litigation. The telegraph was, I suppose, particularly contentious, but every other major invention of the 19th century was also litigated over and over again.
You also suggest that those legal battles left Morse feeling very disillusioned with the American political system.
Yes, he felt that really the patent office failed to support him, the government failed to, Congress failed to support him, they didn't give him enough time, his patent wasn't long enough to really pay him back for all the work and labor he had put into the telegraph. He became very disillusioned about some American institutions.
Well, that sense of disillusionment certainly reached a climax with the coming of the Civil War. He watched with anguish as the war approached. How did that war impact his ideas about American life?
Yes, well, for Morse, it really was a nightmare. It was really the worst thing that could happen. From the beginnings of America, there had been a fear that a republic over such a large territory couldn't be governed, but would split apart. And Morse had felt for years and years before, since the War of 1812, I suppose, that Great Britain and France and a lot of the European countries, it was in their interest to try to disrupt affairs in America, to destroy the government. And he saw it happening now. America at last was falling apart. He saw the European powers cackling in triumph over the splitting of the Union. It was a complete nightmare for him. It was a fulfillment of his worst imaginings about what might happen in the country.
Morse's politics then suggest a deep affection and nostalgia for what was an older and simpler America. And yet it was his invention that helped usher in the modern world that he tried so hard to avoid. Did Morse ever realize the irony there?
That's a very interesting question. I don't think that he did. As a matter of fact, together with talking about this reign of peace that the telegraph was going to bring, in fact, with the Civil War, the telegraph became a major tool on the battlefield for generals directing their troops and sending out orders and finding out what was going on in other lines. The telegraph became very important in the Civil War, and President Lincoln would go to the telegraph office every day to get reports from the front. I don't think that sort of irony ever really registered with him.
Near the end of his life, the first transoceanic telegraph cable was laid. Did Morse ever feel satisfied with his achievements?
That, of course, is another very long story in itself. Morse had no head for business. You know, he was in many ways very naive. The people who were interested in putting together the transatlantic cable really sort of took him and used him without his being aware of what they were doing until, in the end, when the transatlantic cable finally was laid after many attempts, and it finally successfully was laid, I think in about 1863, Morse was not part of the expedition that laid it and really got no credit or very, very little credit for having anything to do with it. In fact, he had foreseen very early on that it was possible to make a transatlantic telegraph.
Have you begun research on another project?
I have, yes. I'm always finding another iconic figure to think about. This one is John Cage, the composer.
Well, thank you, Ken. I hope that you will join us again soon to talk about your next book.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Kenneth Silverman, author of Lightning Man, The Accursed Life of Samuel F.B. Morse, published by Alfred A. Knopf. This is Talking History.
As our guest commentator this week, William Lambers, notes, nearly 50 years ago, President Dwight Eisenhower warned that there was a dangerous competition in armaments throughout the Middle East. Nothing has changed, he suggests. In fact, it may have grown worse. Lambers is the author of Nuclear Weapons and a new book titled The Road to Peace, From the Discovery of the Great Lakes to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty.
In 1958, President Eisenhower stood before the United Nations, warning of a dangerous competition in armaments throughout the Middle East. Today, even with Saddam Hussein's regime eliminated, the Middle East remains heavily armed. There is fear of a regional nuclear arms race. Israel has nuclear weapons, and its rival Iran is suspected of developing them. Other Middle Eastern nations, including Iraq, may feel compelled to produce nuclear weapons as a response to Israel's and Iran's possession of them. The Middle East can avoid the vicious cycle of nuclear proliferation, as one past example suggests. More than 40 years ago, the nations of Latin America also faced the threat of nuclear weapons in their region. In September 1962, Brazil called for a Latin American nuclear weapon-free zone. Just 1 month later, the Soviets placed nuclear missiles in Cuba. The resulting Cuban Missile Crisis almost led to a nuclear war. The Soviet missiles were eventually removed, but the fear of nuclear weapons remained. Latin American leaders urgently sought to prevent nations in their region from developing nuclear weapons, or, like Cuba, hosting those of a superpower. In the midst of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Latin American delegates went to work on a nuclear weapon-free zone treaty. When a treaty was ready for signature, not every nation in the region signed or ratified it. Latin American diplomats also faced the difficulty of convincing the nuclear powers to adhere to the treaty protocols. These protocols prohibited the superpowers from deploying or using nuclear weapons in Latin America. Initially, the United States and other nuclear powers were unwilling to become full parties to the treaty. Latin American diplomats knew that such a treaty would take time to develop. They were wise to get started in 1963. Patient diplomacy was required to bring all the parties to the treaty into agreement. With the Treaty of Tlatelolco, Latin America is now a nuclear weapon-free zone. The Latin American blueprint for regional nuclear disarmament ought to serve as a model for the Middle East. As was the case with Latin America, freeing the Middle East from nuclear weapons will not come about easily. The security concerns of all the nations in the region have to be considered, and tough verification and confidence-building measures established. Failure to act only promotes a burdensome arms race that citizens of the Middle East will have to endure. A nuclear sword could hang over the Middle East and the world for decades to come.
You've been listening to William Lambers, author of Nuclear Weapons, and a new book titled The Road to Peace, From the Discovery of the Great Lakes to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. Next up, Alex Berza. This is Talking History. Most of you are probably aware of Orson Welles' famous 1938 radio dramatization of the War of the Worlds and the panic it created. Less well known is a BBC broadcast made in 1926 of an angry mob looting and destroying parts of London. As Alex Berza explains, the broadcast was quite similar in its nature and effect. Berza is the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium.
On January 16, 1926, BBC Radio abruptly interrupted a broadcast of a speech from Edinburgh to give this special announcement. An angry mob of unemployed workers were running amok in London, looting and destroying everything in sight. Listeners were stunned. Anxiously, they gathered around their radios as the frightening news from London continued. They heard that the Houses of Parliament had been blown up with trench mortars. Quote, "The clock tower, 320 feet in height, has just fallen to the ground, together with the famous clock Big Ben," the reporter excitedly informed them. Fresh reports announced that the crowd had secured the person of Mr. Wotherspoon, the Minister of Traffic, who was attempting to make his escape in disguise. He has now been hanged from a lamppost in Vauxhall. Accompanying the news was the sound of a mob and explosions in the distance. At this point, listeners began to panic. They must have thought of the relatively recent Russian Revolution of 1917 and worried that the same fate was now befalling England. They sat glued to their radios, horrified as the news of the riot went on and on. even though they must have been puzzled by the occasional incongruous details that the announcer threw in, such as when he launched into a description of how the leader of the mob, a man named Mr. Popplebury, was also the secretary of the National Movement for Abolishing Theater Queues. Pretty soon, listeners in London were pouring out into the streets in an attempt to flee the city, while those outside the city rushed to their phones to find out what was going on. Authorities were swamped with frantic calls, and puzzled officials, who swore that nothing was happening, did little to placate callers, who swore back that something had to be happening, because they had heard about it on the radio. Finally, long after the situation had gotten well out of hand, the BBC eased tensions by reminding the audience that the events they had heard were simply part of Father Ronald Knox's comic skit titled Broadcasting the Barricades. The fictitious nature of the skit had indeed been clearly announced at the top of Father Knox's show, but most listeners had forgotten about this warning when confronted with the realistic quality of the broadcast. The BBC broadcast and the incredible reaction it provoked was an ominous sign to many of the enormous power of the relatively new medium of radio. But it proved to be merely a taste of things to come. A far more famous panic occurred a little over a decade later, when a young actor named Orson Welles managed to convince much of the American public that Martians armed with deadly heat ray guns had invaded New Jersey. But that, as they say, is another story.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes, published by Dutton Books, and the curator of the virtual museum of the same title, which you can find at www.museumofhoaxes.com. That brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As usual, we remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that our producer is Fiona Beattie, that our studio engineer is Alex Smith, and that the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, we invite you to send us your comments on this show by email, if you wish, to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.